Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here, and today we are broadcasting live from Fall Creek, Wisconsin, talking with some, we have a great audience here. The place is packed at the Wise Nature Center at the Beaver Creek Reserve, a wonderful place, and we're going to learn a lot more about it as we talk with our guest today. One of them is Eric Keisler. Eric is the Reserve Executive Director. Eric, welcome to the show.
Long-time listener, first-time speaker. It's exciting.
And Megan Giesler, another of our guests, is one of the naturalists here and is the Butterfly House Coordinator. And great to have you with us, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And third, last but not least, Jeanette Kelly, who is the Citizen Science and Education Director at the Reserve. She told me she's a big fan of Scott Craven.
It is true. It is true. My favorite professor.
Her favorite professor. Anyway, Jeanette, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
Thanks for coming, Larry. Appreciate it.
So as we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. Here in the audience, you can just raise your hand, and Jill Nadeau, our producer, will be running around with a microphone, and raise your hand, and she will find you. However, if you're not here and you're listening online or on the radio, you can just call in with your questions. You ever wonder what about the plants and animals that the Beaver Creek Reserve call home? Maybe you have a reserve of your own that you want to talk about in your area. Maybe you have other questions about butterflies. We got a butterfly expert with a big smile on her face right now.
Oh, yeah.
We can talk about birds. We can talk about a lot of things. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Well, I got a tour of the center here, and I was amazed. Maybe talk a bit about what all you can do at the Beaver Creek Reserve.
That's a big question, Larry.
Yes, it is.
That's a big question. So Beaver Creek has been around for over 75 years, and this nature center was built in 84 and then added on in 93, and really was a hub for field trips for many years. In the last 3 decades, most people had their sixth grade overnight in the youth camp across the road. And many people learned about a lot of conservation and ecological topics. Many people also had their first kiss behind one of the cabins across the road. But we've been a hub for about a 90-mile radius for field trips over the last 12 years that I've been here, for sure. And then we do summer camps as well in the summer. We've actually gotten a partnership with our local 5 school districts, and we run a summer school through Beaver Creek, and those students get to come to these summer camps for free. We also have transportation from Altoona and Eau Claire to bring students out to Beaver Creek, so they get to no cost and free transportation to learn about butterflies, kayaking, reptiles, all sorts of great topics that we teach about here at Beaver Creek. And then we rent out equipment. So we rent out kayaks, we rent out snowshoes, cross-country skis. We're the place where a lot of people cut their teeth on environmental outdoor recreation tasks. And so there really is 365 days a year of topics that we cover, and we try to be almost a nature center, but a community center. There's a group that does quilting. There's a group that does watercolor. We have an astronomy club that utilizes the facility. So from the stars to under your feet, right? We're doing just about everything.
And Megan, what kinds of animals call this place home?
Oh, I mean, there's so many that you could think of. You know, I love butterflies, so I'm going to talk about that a lot. But we, you know, in Wisconsin, we have over 150 butterfly species. We see a lot of them here at the reserve in the Chippewa Valley. We also have lots and types of mammals as well. We have bears in the area. I have not seen one yet, but I know that we have them in the area. But, you know, we see a lot of mammals such as coyotes, wolves, and then a large bird species as well. Jeanette could talk more about that piece, but lots of bird species as well.
How did you become, well, I ask this of all of you, how did you become working here?
Yeah.
Come to work here?
That's a great question. I went to school at Stevens Point and studied environmental education and interpretation and have done a lot of seasonal work all around the Midwest. I've worked for the Minnesota DNR, worked for UW Extension, and then ended up coming here and stayed here. I love it so much.
Yeah. Jeanette, what about you?
Well, I was initially looking to come to this area actually because I was getting married and my husband was over in this area. But before I came here, actually, someone who had volunteered for me talked a lot about Beaver Creek. They were from this area and used to tell me about Beaver Creek Reserve. And so when I moved over here, I actually started volunteering here. And then when my predecessor was leaving, she came to me and said, "Get your resume ready." And I did. And here I am.
And Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I graduated from UMD with an outdoor rec degree that had a lot of environmental education facets to it, and I grew up in Eau Claire. This was my nature center. I've been coming here for my whole 43 years.
You got your first kiss here?
Yeah.
Let's get into some detail on that.
I don't see Katie here, so I think
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife, I met up at the Y camp. I worked at a Boy Scout camp. I worked and ran an outdoor program for Michigan Tech up in the UP. And so all of that young professional skills really kind of
came
played.
Came before here.
Yeah,
for
you.
Sure. I grew up on a 360-acre farm, so I kind of have, I was on every acre of that land. And so when I hear 400 acres, I've got a sense for the size of the whole center, of the whole reserve, that's a huge amount.
Yeah, and Beaver Creek is in a special place in Wisconsin, right? We're
yeah.
in this transition area from the southern, you know, kind of open prairie, historically farm fields to the south, and the boreal forest, you know, the pine barrens to the north. So we get, you know, unique butterflies. We get unique birds that Jeanette and Megan can talk about. But this is a really special and unique area in Wisconsin. And the visitors and volunteers and members are all very passionate about the different things that you can find here at Beaver Creek and on these 400 acres in the whole county.
How is it all funded?
Great question. So this is your nature center. This is Eau Claire County facilities. These are buildings and land owned by Eau Claire County. All of the staff that are here talking today are friends of Beaver Creek Reserve, and we have a public-private partnership with the Eau Claire County in a 10-year contract, and that has been a very unique model. It's an extremely successful model, but even in the country, most friends of organizations help the friends of Yellowstone National Park, right? They're not the ones that end up taking over the responsibility of running it all. And this is a small budget, but a relatively large facility. And so we leverage volunteers and donations. And because we've been around for 75 years, we have a lot of really great neighbors, a lot of really great partners, very dedicated board, staff. So it's really fun to be a friend of so many people and the director at Beaver Creek.
Yeah, absolutely. Jeanette Kelly, Megan Gafer, and Eric Keisler, our guests today as we talk about the Beaver Creek Reserve and about the Nature Center itself. And you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Maybe you have a question about the reserve, or maybe you just have a naturalist type question. Amy in Door County, as a matter of fact, online. Let's go there. Hi, Amy.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Hi, I have a question about monarch butterflies. Two questions. One is that I heard a year or two ago that those folks who had been raising the caterpillars inside to release them out into the environment once they were hatched from their chrysalis, I heard that scientists discovered that that wasn't actually working out that great for the butterflies. I'm looking for confirmation or the story behind that. And then number two is my comment, which is so far this year, I haven't really seen that many monarchs, and nor have I seen one single egg on my milkweed plants. Any comments about that?
No, these are great questions. I'm going to start off with your first one. You know, that's a balance that we are looking at as well. But something to go along with that, with raising monarchs, there are people that do it in the wrong way. They are putting them in really small containers, or they are just putting as many as they can in, or they're not cleaning their spaces. They're a living thing, so they are going to need to be cleaned every single day. They need fresh food every single day. We here at the reserve, we do raise monarch caterpillars, but we have a very strict system on how we do it. We are cleaning out our buckets with a diluted bleach system to avoid bacteria, disease, and we're getting fresh food every single day. And we do see things that happen, but a lot of this stuff also happens out in nature as well. So making sure you do it the right way. We also see a lot of people that purchase their butterflies or caterpillars online as well, and we really want to discourage people to do that, because that's actually a really big reason why we see a lot of disease happening in monarch caterpillars as well. There's a lot of unknowns out there with that, but one thing I can say is, you know, like any type of animal that you have, making sure that you're taking care of it, making sure that it's clean, it has fresh food, you know, that's the first way to start, and then also not putting so many in a container as well. Here at the reserve, we only put 6 in a container, as we contain that container as well, and so we're always monitoring it. We have volunteers, lovely volunteers that come in every single day to take care of them. But that's just something that I recommend people doing, making sure that you're monitoring them and taking care of them, and don't buy them online.
there we go. That's a great answer, Megan. Thank you so much. And Amy, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I want to talk about, you were just giving us a little education there. I want to talk about education, the programs. Jeanette, you have a myriad of educational opportunities. Tell us about those opportunities that are available around the reserve.
As you said, we do have a myriad of opportunities, and Eric touched on the opportunities for youth, but I definitely want to make sure to point out that we have opportunities for all ages and adults as well. And I'm always very proud to tell people that we educate from birth to I had a 100-plus-year-old gentleman in one of my programs one day, so we cover all ages. And we do programming both that from the naturalist and from some of our educators here at Beaver Creek Reserve, but we also have other people that come in and do education programs, because I hate to say it, but we don't know it all. And there are definitely experts out there with information that we don't have. So we do draw experts in from other areas to share on topics, whether that's with reptiles, spiders, moss lichens. Those are some of the really interesting ones I think that we've had, where we've had professors or other experts come in. So we can talk about different species, or we have done nature art related programs. We have done training we have a bee club and maple syruping that we have volunteers for, like Megan said, working in the butterfly house. Lots of different trainings we offer to have people involved in conservation projects and citizen science projects as well. So really, any topic you can think of, we've probably discussed here at Beaver Creek, and we either taught or trained people about, or if you have suggestions, we are always looking for suggestions of new topics to bring in here as well.
Jeanette Kelly, Megan Giefer, and Eric Keisler, our guests today, as we talk about what's going on at the Wise Nature Center and at the Beaver Creek Reserve. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, having some fun today in Fall Creek, Wisconsin, taking in the natural beauty of this area at the Beaver Creek Reserve, and hearing about what's going on at the reserve and the Nature Center here. It's just wonderful to be able to talk with Jeanette Kelly, Megan Giefer, and Eric Keisler. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. We didn't get, I think I kind of forgot to follow up on the question from Amy, the earlier caller, who wondered about monarch numbers this year, Megan.
Unfortunately, they are pretty low. That's just something that we're seeing. I didn't see my first monarch this year until middle of June, which is very unusual because we typically will see them be kind of at the end of May, be middle of May, but this year is very unusual, and I've probably seen maybe 15 out in the wild this year. So it's a very low number. We look at our numbers, we go on Monarch Watch. It's something that everyone can access. That's how we figure out our overwintering population numbers. So this is numbers of monarchs that are found in Mexico. And last year's numbers, this year it's half that. So it's it's just going down and down more and more. And so it's very sad to see, you know, but I think what we have is we have a lot of people who are very interested in keeping and wanting to raise that number up. And that's honestly the best thing that we need people to do.
Yeah.
But that, you know, there's lots of factors that come into play. It's chemicals and habitat loss and losing of their host plant. And so there's so many factors that come into place that there's not just one singular one. So.
Go ahead, Eric.
One of the things that we strive to do at Beaver Creek, and it's difficult with all the challenges that come across from Mother Nature, but we also try to offer a solution when possible, right? So we do sell a monarch raising kit, and there are instructions on how to do it correctly. So that is available here at Beaver Creek. But we also have a very successful native plant sale. And so the habitat that Megan's talking about, the only way that these butterflies, and I think that's why it's so special that we have a butterfly house and Megan and all the other volunteers that she trains are so successful in teaching this, that each butterfly has its own host plant, right? When I was a kid, I just poked a bunch of holes in the top of a Skippy jar and stuck some grass in there and thought I was raising a butterfly. And we've learned so much since then, right? And so having a native plant sale where, again, it's run by volunteers and we put out 4,000 to 5,000 native plants into this community every year based on those efforts, also provides habitat for all of these butterflies. And so that, you know, monarchs use milkweed, and milkweed was a noxious plant for so many years in so many communities, it wasn't even allowed to be grown, right? So getting that plant into our backyards, into our public parks, and, you know, providing these pollinator gardens is really a big deal and another way that we can be champions for those butterflies outside of just here at Beaver Creek and in your own backyards.
I just yesterday, before coming up, as a matter of fact, I looked out my yard at my native plant area, and there was a monarch, and it was the first one I'd seen.
That's great.
This year, and I thought, wow. When I'm just thinking about coming up here, that I see a monarch, it was it made me feel pretty darn good. We have John emailed us and wonders. Whoops, I'm looking at a screen here, and I just goofed up here a little bit. Oh, can you talk a little about the event being held by JNR Aquatic Animal Rescue at the Beaver Creek Reserve? That's John, an email from John. Jeanette, is that in your bailiwick?
It is. With our aquatic invasive species side of the Citizen Science Center, that is a program that we've been involved with. I think this will be our third year. And it is with JR Aquatics, and it is essentially a pet surrender if you have any non-native species that, I don't even know if it has to be non-native, but I think... there's certain species they don't take, but if you happen to, you know, get a snake or an exotic fish or exotic turtle or exotic lizard, you know, a big bearded dragon, and now 15 years later you're like, this was not the best decision I ever made.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last thing we want to do for the sake of those animals and the sake of our environment is to let them go, especially in north central Wisconsin, because a lot of them will not survive. And so instead of doing something like that, we partner with this organization to help find them a better place to live for the rest of their days. And it's a really neat program, and you can just bring your animals here. People will bring bring the containers that they keep them in, the terrariums, the aquariums, different things like that, and surrender their animals here. And it's a hard thing for a lot of people, Larry. A lot of people are not just wanting to get rid of these animals, but for a lot of people, these have been their companions for a lot of years. And there are tears shed when people are giving up their animal, but they realize they can't, they're not in a situation to have it anymore. They're moving into a different facility. They can't transport it. It's too big for them. And so it's a pretty fabulous partnership. So those animals don't have a cruel life just being let go. And so we don't introduce them into our native system.
Do you actually have quite a few people bringing them in?
We do. We've had chinchillas, dragons, bearded dragons, different types of snakes, fish, birds. A lot of those birds live a long time. People bring in birds, all kinds of different animals. And yeah, each year we've had a fair number of animals donated.
And when does that happen? That's in...
That is coming up soon, in August. August 24th, it'll be here at Beaver Creek Reserve. So definitely check our website or give a call and stop on in if you have an animal. And just to let everyone know, there is no judgment involved in this. The goal of this program is just to make sure that these animals get a good life for the rest of their years and to help people out that are looking to move those animals onto a new place.
Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Our live audience, some member has a question, raise your hand, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, will be there lickety-split with a microphone. Bill in Minon called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondered about or worried about townships and counties that mow down the milkweed and in the ditches. It says that's affecting the population of monarchs and other pollinators, or feels that's the case. And what can be done to help in that situation?
Oh, there's another education. Give me a soapbox to stand on.
I know.
Go, Jeanette.
I'm not even sure if I'm necessarily the best one to handle this, but this is one of my own personal beefs, and I try not to make it necessarily widely known in my own neighborhood, at least not too overly subtle about it. But yeah, I think that's a massive issue. And I moved to Eau Claire 12 years ago. And where I live in Seymour Township, and that area has some of the most beautiful roadsides I have ever seen anywhere in this state. And we have such sandy soil and native plants. When Eric's talking about the native plant sale, there is a plethora of native plants that grow along the roadsides in this area. And in the 12 years I've lived here, I have literally watched butterfly weed, prairie bush clover, cardinal flower, liatris just be mowed down. And it's either for development or it's just clearing space, or it's people thinking, feeling that mowed grass is better than what's there naturally in the wildflowers. And I know myself and our retired naturalist, Jim, we live in the same area, and we used to walk our neighborhood collecting monarchs for the butterfly house here. And it used to be you could just walk outside your house down the road. Now you have to walk a mile and a half down the road to even find milkweed, to find a caterpillar on it. So just a thought for yourself and your own personal space. Mowing grass takes your time, it takes your money, it takes fuel. And if you just let it go back to native plants, it's pretty amazing. I have a ditch in front of my yard that we haven't mowed in 12 years. And you'd be welcome to drive by my house and see how tall the cup plants are right now, and the liatris blooming, and the echinacea, and the butterfly weed. And I will say that 3 years ago, a creamy gentian showed up in my ditch, and I don't know how it got there, whether it was just in the seed bank or what, but at the time that was listed as a threatened plant in Wisconsin. So how cool is that? I just stopped mowing, and look what happened.
But what happened to your exercise? You're not getting it right.
Well, Larry, I have a dog, and I have two young kids, so.
Oh, my gosh. Let's take a call from Jan in Middleton. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks. I'm wondering, out in front of our business, there is a lot of milkweed, some of which in one area has a shiny surface on the milkweed, and I think it has something to do with aphids, but I'm not sure. Could you tell me what that is?
You are exactly right. That's what it is. It is aphids. We see it here at Beaver Creek. We see it here in the butterfly house. It's just something that, you know, that nature comes and is kind of a pest that we see with some of our plants. You know, the best way that I, and a more natural way that I've been able to kind of remove them, because, you know, it kind of doesn't make your plants look very nice. And so I use a spray bottle with some water and some, just a little bit of dish soap, and you keep, and you continue to spray that on your plants that have the aphids. And that should, if you continue to do it, that should, within a week to 2 weeks, it should remove them. But that's a very safe, natural way, and it shouldn't harm any of the other insects that are wanting to use that plant. But we do see that here, too. It's just something common that we find here, especially in the butterfly house.
Huh? And yeah. Megan, I have noticed, and maybe you know about this, but I have noticed that if my milkweed has aphids on it and that sticky, shiny material substance she's talking about, I notice that monarchs don't seem to lay their eggs on those. Is that what you know as well?
I typically don't see them lay their eggs. Sometimes I'll see the caterpillars on that piece, but usually they'll go to a better piece. Another way to remove that and get rid of that leaf is, it is okay to take a snipping tool and snip the tops of your milkweed. That will encourage growth, and it will actually end up having two more shoots that will shoot at the top. We really encourage this, especially for our monarch caterpillars, that we continue having fresh milkweed throughout the summer as well. So if you have milkweed at home and you see that, you know, either you can use a Donger soap method, or you can just snip it, because it will grow back and it will come back even more beautiful.
All right. Very good questions there, and good responses. I want to talk about, go back to Jeanette for a bit to talk about some of the citizen science projects that you have going. There are a bunch of them.
There are, and I've always said that one of the most exciting parts of my job as a citizen science director is that I am constantly learning new things, and I bet I have worked on over 36 different projects since I've been here. And I also say that that's the most exciting part, but that's also the most challenging part, is I'm always learning something new. And the citizen science projects we have at Beaver Creek, just to explain that, step back a second. So what citizen science means is that any of you here in the room or any of you listening on the radio, if you are interested in being part of science and being part of some conservation efforts to help our surrounding areas and our animals worldwide, you can get involved with one of our projects. And it doesn't mean you have to know anything about birds, butterflies, freshwater mussels, bats, fireflies. You just have to have an interest and a desire to learn about them. And you come and see us at the Citizen Science Center. We will train you, we will educate you, and we will let you know the way to become part of these larger projects and to help contribute to science and conservation. And so through the years, we've worked on freshwater mussels, fireflies, Karner blue butterflies, birds, kestrels, owls. We've worked on non-native species, both terrestrial and aquatics, aquatic invertebrates. We really have a gamut of things that we have learned about. And one thing that is very cool is that several of our citizen science projects have been 100% started and run by our amazing volunteers. And to me, that's citizen science coming full circle, when the public is coming to us and saying, hey, you know what, Jeanette, we are concerned about solitary bees. We are concerned about frogs. We are concerned about this. I think we should look into it. And that's where a project starts. That's pretty phenomenal.
There's one. You have one involving bats, do you not?
We do. We work with the Wisconsin DNR to help monitor bats throughout the state. And we have a cool little gizmo called an Anabat, and you can borrow it from us, and you can go on a hike, you can go on a bike ride, you can go out on your pontoon boat, just please invite me along, and you can go out and survey bats in the evening time. It's a really cool part project to get you out at night when a lot of us aren't out at night, just enjoying and learning about what's out there at nature in nature. And you just walk around with this little handheld instrument, and it records the echolocation of the bats, and it can identify the bats. So on the Anabat, it'll tell you what species and how many of that species you're seeing, and then all that information we share back with Wisconsin DNR in their bat monitoring program. And bats,
that is
like,
really cool.
It's very cool. It's super fun, and it's a great entertainment for all ages. And it's definitely a concern because, like our butterflies, our bats are not doing really well either. So it's definitely something that conservationists are interested and concerned about.
Last year, my daughter had an internship with the DNR and did water surveying and fish surveying in streams and rivers across Wisconsin. So she had a kind of a fun summer. And I know that there's some water sampling and testing going on here as well. Describe that.
Yeah, so through our aquatic invasive species section of our Citizen Science Center, we have a couple different projects. We have Citizen Lake Monitoring Network, which is again a program with the DNR that we host here as well. And that's looking at clarity of water. It's also looking at invasive species that might be in there, both plants or animals. And in some cases, it's also doing some amount of chemistry on the water just to see where the water's at. And those that's, again, a project that you can get involved with here at Beaver Creek, and just to help make sure that your lakes are doing well. There's also, Beaver Creek doesn't have this program here anymore, but we did for a lot of years, and you can still get involved with it through the extension. UW Extension is the Water Action Volunteers, which if you're on a river or a stream, that's a similar program to help monitor your stream and make sure your stream is healthy.
How does the information that's collected get used? Can you give me an example of a good use and how things kind of worked out?
Yeah, that's a great question because a lot of volunteers want to know that. Well, I'm out here doing all this work. Is it just because it's really fun, or is it because it's actually making a difference? And we strive to make sure that the citizen science projects we have and that we have people participate in are actually making a difference. So depending on the project, that information is always being shared with a larger organization. So for instance, the programs we work on with partnership with the DNR, for instance, the bat, that goes back to the bat biologist in the state. And so they have all that information. Because the beauty of citizen science is, if you think about it, one person covering a multi-county area can't look at everything and can't keep track and monitor everything. So they're dependent on folks like myself and all of you to help bring in that information. And so that's where they're going to get all their information about bats. Otherwise, they're never going to know about bats across the state. A lot of our bird information, I should say all of our bird information, that gets shared with the Bird Banding Lab, which is out in Maryland with the federal government. And anyone can access that data. And so, Larry, we've had several grad students and PhD students that have contacted us or contacted the Bird Banding Lab for information on whatever species they are studying. Recently, we had a graduate student that was very interested in American kestrels, a small raptor, and they utilized all of our information we have from 15 years of studying kestrels and were able to determine their nesting success and what are potential failures of their nesting and how we can work to change those issues and help with the conservation of them. Mm. So we partner with a lot of different organizations. And even if it's individual organizations like the American Kestrel Partnership, we share our data with them, but then we also share it with the big bird banding data site out in Maryland.
John was showing me, I was getting a tour of the facility, and I saw the bird feeding setup, which, boy, I wish I had something like that. Although it would be a very time-consuming, because there's a lot of feeders there, but there was also a net.
Oh, was there a net out there for trapping birds? Sure. Yeah, so we do trap and band birds here at Beaver Creek. We have been trapping and banding birds for 25 years, approximately. And a lot of that data, the information we gain from that is, as I said, shared with different organizations and with the federal government. And we learn things as far as migration patterns, longevity of birds, birds that are breeding. If we see suddenly, Megan was talking about the lack of monarchs, if all of a sudden we don't see any chickadees, well, then we can say, hey, something's happening with the chickadees. And we've learned really cool information throughout the banding program. For many years, we here at Beaver Creek Reserve upped the record of longevity for a white-breasted nuthatch, which might not seem like a big deal, but hey, it's a big deal. So prior to that, they knew a nuthatch could live, say, 6 years and 7 months, and then we happened to catch a nuthatch that had been banded when it was first hatched, and we then found out that bird could actually live to 6 years and 9 months.
And, beat them by 2 months.
Right, but you know, think about that here. We have a group of volunteers that are part of this science, and right here in Little Fall Creek, look how we are contributing to that larger scientific community. And I will say, someone now has caught an older white-breasted nuthatch than us. But we have had birds that have been recovered. We had a rose-breasted grosbeak a few years ago recovered in Nicaragua. So the bird that were at our feeders here at Beaver Creek went and wintered in Nicaragua. We had an indigo bunting that we banded one summer and then didn't see for 6 years. And all of a sudden it showed back up. What the heck had he been doing? Where had he been? And all of a sudden he comes right back to our feeders. So we're learning about migration, about longevity. That bird had migrated back and forth all those years and it survived. We learn a wealth of information through bird banding.
Barbara in Cross Plains has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Thank you all for telling us all these wonderful facts and fun things to do. My husband and I are 78. He started using a cane, and now we're definitely out with our walking stick when we want to explore nature. How much can we see and do if we have those limitations?
Great question. So Beaver Creek, again, is sitting on the shoulders of so many great things, right? We've all been here for 12, 13 years, and that banding data has been here for 20. We have great inputs from all the different community and have other people who have mobility issues. And one of our staff reached out and got a partnership and figured out how to get a tracked wheelchair. And so our local ADRC county group helped us get a track chair, and we're able to work with a local Eagle Scout from the local Boy Scout troop, and he made some of our access points down our trails to be safe enough to bring the track chair down into the floodplain forest along Beaver Creek. And so you can actually go out in a miniature tank. It's incredibly stable and is as fast as able-bodied people can walk. And we have 400 acres that you can explore, right? And all these wonderful things that Megan and Jeanette have been talking about, you'd be able to see firsthand. So we're very prideful of that. We also have an improved service trail that allows people to walk past the youth nature nooks that kids can come and play on, and it goes past the butterfly house. We also have we can use that mobile chair. We have an elevator that can get you down. There's some more solid surfaces as well as some of the more remote trails. So there's opportunities for every age demographic, like Jeanette was saying, from 100 to 1. We want to be here for people. Our mission is connecting people with nature. And again, if we didn't have these great partnerships in our community, we wouldn't be able to connect as many people as we do. And so as we continue to look at the facility and make improvements, we've been upgrading our trails where we can to be ADA compliant, and there's been a lot of forethought here from the generations of people before who have made a lot of those improvements. So again, it's just an ongoing effort here at Beaver Creek to embrace all different mobility types, peoples, and we want to make sure that everybody feels welcome here.
And you have an elevator in the building here to get people from one floor to the next. Mm-hmm. So the building itself is also great for anyone to travel through. Jeanette Kelly, Megan Giefer, and Eric Keisler are guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting live today from the Beaver Creek Museum, but it's not a museum. It's a reserve, although there are some lovely mounts and what might be considered museum pieces when it comes to wildlife here in the facility. Great to have Jeanette Kelly, Megan Giefer, and Eric Eisler as our guests today. And you can join in with your questions and comments, and we have a question from our live audience.
Yes, I just wanted to ask about the Hobbs Observatory and how do you use it?
Yeah, this was kind of a surprise to me. I don't know why, but man, there's even an observatory here.
Beaver Creek is, again, blessed with so many community connections, and a professor from UW-Eau Claire helped get that observatory in place back in the 1980s. And so we've had over 40 years of astronomers, hobbyists, and people just interested in celestial activities, right, happening here at Beaver Creek Reserve. And so that's open to the public from May to October on Saturday evenings from 9 to about midnight. And we have a very dedicated group called the Chippewa Valley Astronomy Society who volunteers their time so that the public can see these, huge telescopes that are actually owned by the university, as well as their own, like, hobbyist scopes that are almost, the technology has come along in the last 40 years where you can almost see better from this telescope that they'll bring out from their own trailers and they're connected to an iPod, and then they know the Greek mythology and all the constellations, and I can't tell you how many times here at Beaver Creek there are epiphany moments, right, that just happen that people are just wowed by. But when you see literally the rings around Saturn, right, and to this group, they're looking at double nebula, things, smudges in the thing. I don't even know what they are. They're so talented and have so many great things that they're tracking and watching. But that is a great resource. And Larry, there are not many nature centers that have an astronomy, program, let alone a whole nother group of dedicated volunteers that want to bring that to the community. So they do a star fest and they bring people from all over, and they put up their amateur telescopes in our fields once a year. And so if astronomy is something that you're interested in for one night or want to get more involved, that's another great group that utilizes Beaver Creek.
And what you've got going for you is lack of light.
It is great. Yeah. We just had a piece about the meteor showers that happened last weekend, and those people that got to come out also got to see the Northern Lights, and we're in a up cycle. I'm sure many people have seen the Northern Lights now in the last few years, and it's just been breathtaking. But that swell is like every 20 years, and so we're getting to see a bunch of it now, and we might not see it for another 20 years, at least at this rate. So it's nice to have friends in that group that also train some of our AmeriCorps staff and people to do programs here as well. Many of the youth group that still comes to the cabins across the road, we were originally the Eau Claire County Youth Camp. So there's 132 beds, a main lodge, a shower house. We are a camp for people who don't have a camp. Many YMCAs and scouts have their own facilities, but many church groups and youth groups come here and actually have their summer camp, or university club comes and has an overnight experience here, much like those sixth graders in the past. So we're a facility that does that, and if your stay happens to be during that season when the astronomy is open, you can come and visit, or you can set up an actual program from that group if their volunteers are available.
It's just great, great, great facility. Question from the audience.
Well, it's a question and an answer, maybe. My sister and I pick elderberries wild, and we picked them last summer. And we were approached by two young men on an ATV and a spray unit. And he said, when you get done picking there, we're coming down the other way, and we will be spraying the ditch to kill everything. So is there anything we can do about that? That's for the electric company. This is out by St. Bridget's.
There have been, there have been a number of instances where landowners, for example, I happen to be friends with a guy who has worked very hard with local government and with the power company for dealing with just that. I think it actually takes, at a local level, talking with local representatives, actually approaching and talking with the power companies. And he was able to work out a little something. He didn't get everything he wanted, but it was a lot better than what he had. So it's just something that I think any of us who are interested in this really need to get involved with our local politicians and local officials, because that's where those decisions are made.
Yeah, and I mean, it's difficult anytime we're dealing with conflicting interests, right? Yep. I would love to eat some of those elderberries, but I know that the power companies have also done a really good job of replanting lupin, which is the host plant for Carner blue butterflies, right? And yeah. So if you look under a lot of these power lines, that's some of the few places that you actually see lupin grow. And so if there's things that are going to grow up into the vines and cut out power that we all need to survive as well, trying to work with your local municipalities, again, cutting down wildflowers and ditches is sometimes a visibility issue. We like wildlife, and then we don't like to hit deer. So there's always conflicts and how we work with them. I know that the local county highway department here is putting a suppressant down so that the grasses and flowers don't grow as much, so they have to mow less. I don't really know what the long-term effects on any of that is, but I know that there are different things being attempted constantly, and people want to see nature and Mother Nature thrive, right? Like, I don't think any of it is necessarily untoward, but how do we have those conversations with our local leaders and power companies to continue to try to make a place where we can live and thrive together, right? We want to see more butterflies. We want to eat those berries. We want to see the flowers and have those pollinators in our yards. And so I think Larry's approach is a good one.
Another question from the audience.
You guys have talked about so many amazing things, but could you guys talk about the green energy initiatives that you have here at the center? I know you guys have solar energy on the roof, and also, if you can, any green energy initiatives you plan on working toward in the future?
Yeah, great question. So when the Nature Center was built in 1984, there was a windmill out here. There was hot water solar that helped heat the building. The tree in the lobby, if you've been here or come visit, actually had a heat coil, and when off-peak energy was really, the disparity was really great, you could save a lot of money by heating at night. You would actually heat up the whole tree, and it would give off heat through the rest of the day. So there's some really innovative things even back into the 80s. Right now, solar is kind of the most efficient way to do that. We have buildings that have geothermal heat, but we did come up with a plan and then just happened to find a donor that supported that plan. And so we're 100% solar powered for all of our electrical needs here at Beaver Creek. We've got 143 panels on the Nature Center. We also have a great partnership with our local energy co-op, and they put a solar array in the community, and we bought into their solar array. And because we couldn't afford all of it, they also offered leases, and so we lease solar from them. So we own in a system, and we lease from a system. And so that all of our electrical needs are part of the we don't bank the energy, but we're generating all of our own electrical throughout a year. So that's exciting, and they helped us get a grant to put electrical vehicle charging stations in our parking lot. And so we have spent a lot of time just from a sustainability issue here at Beaver Creek. The costs of energy are real in our own homes and in any business or community. Yeah. And so if we can cut down on any of those energy costs, the focus on energy, switching all of our bulbs to LEDs, we were one of the first adopters of that. And so Beaver Creek, part of our mission, part of our strategic goals, is to be a community example, right? And show people that this can be done and that you don't have to have an electric car or do all these things. We have a we have a very robust Earth Week challenge where we encourage people to just turn off the lights, right? One of the best ways to not waste energy is to not use energy, right?
And on that note, we're going to have to close.
Hey.
It was great talking with the three of you. And the Beaver Creek Reserve, Jeanette Kelly, Megan Giefer, and Eric Kiesler, our guests today. Great to have them with us on WPR News. And thank you very much. With us on WPR News, Larry Mueller here as we broadcast from Fall Creek, Wisconsin. There we are. We are at the Beaver Creek Reserve, and it's just a wonderful facility and great to be here. And we've got a guest for you who's almost a resident, and at least he lives pretty darn close to the reserve, I think. Michael Perry with us on the show now for the next hour. You know Michael, he's a speaker, he's an author. He's a musician, he does lots of things. His most recent book I really liked, I'm going to talk with him about it at some point. It's titled 40 Acres Deep. And I want to talk with him about that and maybe his multimedia project. He's got his voicemail, which I'm on his list for that. And we'll talk about that. And maybe many here are very familiar with his work. And if you want to join in, are you a fan of his work? Why does it resonate with you? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org, or somebody in our audience can just raise their hand and Jill Nadol will run with a microphone. Michael Perry, good to have you with us today. Thank you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me so close to home.
Yeah, how close is close?
Well, I was in Minneapolis this morning, so it really wasn't that close. But we have a little farm. Well, it's a farm. It's been fallow for years, but about 15 minutes from here. Yeah. My wife grew up in Fall Creek, so...
So you've spent some time here.
Yeah, my daughters went to school here. And as a matter of fact, Beaver Creek Reserve has been a big part of our life here because, first of all, when folks come to visit, you know, you always want something to do. Where can we take you? And this is one of the go-to places, especially if they have young kids. It's a great place to bring company. And then also in the previous hour, they mentioned that it was a camp at one time, and I know several years ago we had a big old honking family reunion and we rented a bunch of those buildings over there and the kitchen and everything and had some wonderful family time here at the reserve. And then the last thing I'd say is that my daughters have both attended Wildland Schools, which is right across the road, and Beaver Creek partners with them on a lot of nature and science projects.
So, very, very close connection. What is it about this part of the Wisconsin? I mean, northern Wisconsin. Kind of northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, kind of. I was talking to my brother this morning. He was logging up north of Highway 8. So, I don't want to get too carried away about how northern we are. But now, when I'm out on book tour, yes, I'm definitely from northern Wisconsin.
Here people know better.
That's right. It just depends on who's listening. But, you know, honestly, it's like every other. So part of me knows I'm supposed to say this is just a super beautiful, wonderful area of the country, and it is. The deep green. You know, I was talking to someone just the other day about whenever you mention you're from Wisconsin, you get comments about the frozen tundra. And, of course, we have our winters. But people miss the fact that, man, summer here is just steamy and jungly and thriving and thick and beautiful and fertile and fecund, if I may. And but then also, like, just even early here in August, we're getting that first little taste of where there's a couple of those mornings where you go, oh, here it comes. Yeah, and so I think the texture of this area is just lovely. But then ultimately, too, it comes down to the people, and the people, it just depends on who you choose to hang out with.
Well, here you were hanging out in Minnesota, not Minneapolis. I mean, you get around. I mean, what's going on what's happening in your life this time?
You know, I'm in one of those stages where not a lot is coming out publicly, but just working on a lot of things behind the scenes, a couple of different books. I have a very, very overdue sequel. I wrote a book called The Scavengers, and people are always asking when the sequel is coming out, and for about 10 years I've been saying in 2 years. but I did receive word from one of my editors that they feel like maybe I really ought to get her done. So I'm working on that, and then I'm working on an odd little book that I don't know if it'll come out or not, but it's someone asked me to give a little talk about, you know, I've been a self-employed guy since 1992. I quit my last real job, and so someone asked me to write about art and trying to, you know, create beauty and be thoughtful and I hope at times artistic, but also pay for the kids' braces and pay for health insurance. And so I'm working on a very short little book about that, kind of the intersection of art and commerce, but based on unlikely mentors, the people I ran into who prepared me for this life long before I ever knew I was going to be doing this life.
Yeah.
And for instance, like what I learned from my nursing studies that actually prepared me to interview people and to interact with people. I'm very shy. I would prefer to never come out of my little room, but I've learned how to perform and I've learned how to do interviews like this. And then a lot of my writing required me to sit down with strangers and ask them questions. Well, I just revert back to the UW School of Nursing where they taught me to go into a tiny room with a complete stranger, have them take their clothes off and ask about their bowel habits. So those folks were preparing me to be a writer. And also, I just want to say, I had no idea. This is a shout out that will be meaningful only to two people in this room. But when I got out of my car, the guy who parked right beside me was my big brother in nursing school. So shout out to Joe RN from Nakusa, Wisconsin. We both look exactly the same as we did in 1984.
You have another
book? Oh, so yeah, working on books, and then I'm touring all the time. I mean, I don't really ever stop touring, and I like to say tour because it sounds fancy, and people think of giant, shiny buses dieseling through the night, but really it's just me in a 2002 Toyota van with the seats tore out and boxes of books and tubs of T-shirts, and it just never stops. I just do, you know, I do corporate speaking gigs. I speak at libraries. I'm doing a thing here in La Crosse in a couple of weeks about farmer mental health. I do humorous, you know, one-man shows. And just a couple of days ago, played a show with my band, The Long Bed. So just always working on new stuff.
You gotta be doing a lot of, you got your fingers in a lot of pies.
Got to, yeah. It's, cause, you know, the one thing I will say is that none of it happens if I don't sit down alone and do the writing. Whether it's a song, whether it's a speech, whether it's a book, at some point I have to sit down and write. And that's my first love, and I can't believe I'm allowed to do it. But I learned from growing up on the farm, my dad, you know, I always say he was a dairy farmer, but we logged in the winter. So I grew up milking cows, but also slinging slabs and skidding logs. And then he also had sheep, and he said that the old timers taught him that you milk the cows for the milk check. That's what you hope would be your regular income. You log in the winter because everything else is froze up, and then you raise the sheep because on a good year between the lambs and the wool, you could maybe cover the property taxes. And that's just kind of how I realized I was never going to be a million seller, super rich, can't sit at home and live off my royalties guy. I just got to keep hustling, but that's kind of in me, and I like the work, and I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, I know you are. And you and I have been talking together for a long time. I mean, I think I first interviewed you when Population 485 came out, which has got to be 24 years ago, maybe?
22 years ago. It came 22? Out in October of 2002. Yeah, and that book, I mean, that book still continues to just have a life of what a privilege and stroke of luck to be allowed to write that book about that place at that time.
Oh, man, yeah. that is a great book. And I want to talk about, we'll get to it, I want to talk about the play that you wrote based on the book. But I want to talk about, I think it's your most, you know, I know it's your most recent book, which is 40 Acres Deep. And I love that book.
Oh,
the writing, you're such a great writer, and that story is it's just an amazing story. Maybe give a little overview.
Well, first I want to take a risk. You know, I was really raised. my parents tried to teach us two things: charity and humility. And humility is tricky when you're in a business that requires you to promote yourself constantly.
Yeah.
And some have remarked on this, possibly my own father. So I'm always really careful how I talk about what I do, because it's, you know, I'm self-employed. That's the bottom line. But 40 Acres Deep, I really hesitated for a long time about bringing that book out. I really don't think of myself as a capital W writer or a capital A artist. Nobody's waiting breathlessly for my wisdom. But I do want to put my heart and soul into what I do. And whether it's a humorous monologue or a book about art and commerce, I want there to be soul and heart in it, even if it's serving a pretty well-defined purpose. And there are times when I feel like, you know, if I'm telling the story about the beer tent again, that maybe it seems like I'm coasting. And I hope not, because I still love telling the beer tent story that most people in this room have probably heard multiple times. But 40 Acres Deep, ultimately, a couple of things happened. Number one was it just wouldn't go away. It wouldn't leave my head. And so I thought, I'm going to do it. Also, there's a guy named Sturgill Simpson, who's a singer-songwriter. And he does things his own way, and he's so stubborn, and I love his work. And he came out with an album that was very unpopular right around the time that I was thinking about whether or not I should do this. And I listened to that album the first time, I didn't care for it. And by the third time, I was in love with it. And there's a song in there that just made me think, I'm going to go ahead and write this book. And if it sells two copies, that's okay. And we sent it to New York City, my agent out there, who's terrific, and she just said, yep, this is some of the best writing you've done in 20 years, but the publishers aren't going to want it. It doesn't really fit their hook. And I said, well, I kind of figured that's what I'd hear. And so we self-published it. We DIY'd it. But the thing that I wanted to say is that then I just, that's, there was no one telling me what to write in that book, and I love being edited. I need instruction. I accept it. But in this case, I just would sit down in the room, and I would just try to get as deep into that character as I could and just write what I was feeling on that character's behalf. And I also wanted to write the way I used to write in the coffee shop in 1992 when it was bad poetry, but I was so moved, and I felt that again when I was, I've never lost that. But I felt it every time I sat down to work on that tiny little book. And so the part that I'm cautious about saying, because I don't want it to come off as bragging, but I call that book my Just So You Know book. So I can tell funny cow stories, but I can write that book as well.
Yeah,
so
it is.
So ultimately it was just thinking about a farmer struggling to hang on to his, not just his farm, but his life. And then the farmer is also representative of so many of us who feel things changing and the good guys don't always win, and feeling powerlessness, and what do you do about that? And yet how do you still try to see and feel beauty in the world? And so I just went with that character. And I just, on the way here today, I talked to my brother, farms up north. And you know, it's tough for him right now. And so I can't fix that by writing that book, but I hope that I can convey to some other people what that feels like.
Yeah, it's tough for a lot of farmers out there. And I know you, I think you told me once that you even showed the book, the writing, to farmers just to see how they might respond.
Yeah, because the other thing I don't want to do is be the guy who's just dipping his toe into something really heavy and saying, I don't have it all figured out. And so I did send it to a couple of farmers, and also because it's an unrelentingly dark book. It's about suicide, and there's an infant death in there. And so I sent it to some people, and the farmers all just said, yeah, it's a hard story, but you should tell it. And then I sent it to some mental health folks as well and got the same message back, so.
So how's it been received? I mean, it's been out now a year and a half or so.
Well, I'm happy to say, from a strictly, self-employed perspective, it's in its third printing. We've sold thousands of copies of that book that the New York folks didn't want. So, yeah. And by the way, that's not a finger in the... I still work with... I have a contract right now with HarperCollins, and they've been so good to me. There's just some books that it's better for them to be... You know what? Home birth. Sometimes that's the way to go. I had a daughter that way, and I've had a few books that way, and it's worked out just fine.
Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us today for WPR News as we visit now with Michael Perry, New York Times bestselling author, humorist, musician, songwriter, playwright. He's done a lot of things in his life. It's great to have him with us today. Questions for him or comments? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for all the beautiful work you bring into the world, and wanted to ask if you would just talk briefly about your writing routine and or advice for people who are writing and think it's taking them forever.
Well, when you use the word routine, my eyebrows went up. Because I'm not one of those folks that has a real set routine. For years, and I mean decades, I definitely was the guy who said, you must write every day. And I did. No matter what, even if it's a horrible draft, whatever it is, you have to write every day. I've changed that. I met a writer I respected one day, and I started off on my whole, you have to write every day. And he said, well, that's just ridiculous. And I love it when people do. I have another friend he's my friend that when I spend a lot of time alone. I have this theory that writers and truckers and farmers, people like that who spend a lot of time alone, we develop what we call capital T theories, and we polish them and we burnish them because there's no one there to contradict us. And then I have a couple of friends where I'll trot out my very precious theory, and they'll listen patiently, and then they'll go, well, that's just not how it is at all. And those people are very valuable. And this writer did that for me. He said, no, there's some days when you're just not going to get anything done. You might as well go and work on something else. And I've come to believe that that is right. I do, however, you have to put the miles in. There's just, I work with musicians. I know 3 or 4 chords and 2 strum patterns. That's different than a musician who's worked chords every day or who has worked scales and chords and can transpose on the fly and things like that. And so for me, I did have to write every day. As far as my routine now, it's honestly been driven by the same thing for the last 25 years, and that is I'm freelance. So I'm writing with the hope that at the end of the writing, whether I'm writing a script, like lately I've done a couple of script projects, I do some voiceover work, I do a weekly podcast with a little essay in it, books, whatever, it all, I have to be able to write. But because I'm doing so many different things and because it's how we support our family, I operate based on my nursing and EMT background knowledge of triage, which is to say what absolutely has to be done now to keep the patient alive. And so when I get up in the morning, that's generally it. It's like, what's due next? Just a lot of writing all the time. And then I do allow myself plenty of time when it's available to just write without constraint. And the 40 Acres Deep book was an example of that, where it's like, I think as a writer, I need to work on this project.
Well, it's that particular book was just so meaningful to me. I grew up on a farm, and we didn't have things go the way. It's the old story about, you know, what if you got $1 million? Well, I'll just keep farming until it's gone.
Yep. I did an event the other night. So this, I was asked to speak at an event recently, and it was one of those where you weren't sure quite what you were getting into, and it was in a remote area, and they told me there'd be a bunch of farmers there, but I wasn't sure. And it turned out to be just one of the most lovely evenings. But I stepped to the microphone, and I looked out at the crowd, and I have to kind of decide on the fly my material, and what am I going to do tonight? And I thought, well, they said there's a lot of farmers here, so I'm going to test to see if that's true. And I told a joke where I said, you know, I said something about, does anybody here know why farmers don't wear tennis shoes? And the punchline is, because it's the only piece of clothing the seed company isn't given away for free. And it got a huge laugh, and I went, okay, all right. We're going to definitely tell the dead cow story. We're going to, you know, like, the manure spreader story. So what were we talking about before? I've made a living off of going off on tangents, so here we are.
You know, I don't remember myself. That's what's kind of fun about talking with you, Mike. We go, you can get off on a little tangent, and you take me there, and then I forgot where I was headed in the first place.
Well, eventually we'll find our way back. Somewhere somebody's yelling at their radio right now. We're talking about raccoons.
Noreen in Mozambique. Let's do it that way. Let's go to somebody else with a question. Noreen, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to let Michael Perry know that he did a library opening in Kobe, Wisconsin, a number of years ago. Begrudgingly, I talked my boyfriend into going along. And I said, we'll sit at the end of the row, way in the back. He's a dairy farmer. If you fall asleep, you fall asleep. I'll just try and keep you from snoring. Well, lo and behold, he paid attention. He sat up straight. He enjoyed it. At the end of the show, and I will tell you, my boyfriend has never in his life read a book. He grew up on a dairy farm. His mother died when he was very young. Nobody really cared, you know, about the education stuff. So he's never read a book. At the end, you read the story when your niece had passed away, and the plane flew over, and he cried. And he was just so engrossed by that story. And from then on, like if we're going on a long trip, I'll bring one of your books and I'll read to him. And he really enjoys that. So.
Well, thank you. That, you know, that means so much to me because I live in the in-betweens all the time. I grew up on a dairy farm, grew up with roughnecks, I grew up logging and farming, but I loved books, and my mom taught me how to read, and she filled the house with books, and people in the arts world, poets and dancers and beautiful people, have added this whole other dimension to my life that I never even anticipated, and yet I'm still perfectly happy to go home and just shoot the breeze with loggers, and so any time that we can cross that little gap, I'm so grateful for that story. And you also mentioned it was my nephew that I had written about. And it's tricky when you write nonfiction memoir because sometimes I'm writing other people's stories and I don't know if that's selfish and I don't know if I have a right sometimes. And in that case, of course, I got permission, but I remember talking to my brother one time. I'd written about a terrible loss he'd experienced, and I got his permission to write about it. And I told him one time, I said, you know, it isn't that I got to tell your story. It's the number of people who've come to me and said that your story helped them. And to be able to tell him that was very meaningful. So thank you for sharing that. And then now that I've gotten all heavy, like, yeah, I also like, I love telling stories about guys getting kicked by dead cows and things like that. You gotta have both, you know.
You gotta have both. That's such a great story to read. Thank you so much for calling. Rachel in Neillsville, I believe, has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. Yes. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say that I bought the book 40 Acres Deep last year, and it was just I very much appreciated it. I shared it with a brother of mine, kept pestering him to give it back to me, and he finally did. I had someone that I lost to suicide in early 2023. But as a native Wisconsinite, it was perfect for me. And I just really appreciate your guest and the show, Larry.
Thank you very much for calling, Rachel.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for being brave enough to call in and say that. I think there is, again, this balance between not indulging in darkness, but also exploring darkness and just talking about these things. And I can tell you, man, it's all over. So yeah. Thank you for calling and saying that.
I do have to say, in that book, there were some smiles.
I will say, so I should let you talk.
Go ahead. I mean,
it's your show.
I just wanted you to come. I mean, well, there are some funny instances in that book too. I mean, it's not all doom and gloom.
If I may, actually, now that you mention it, so I mentioned earlier that I avoid the idea of designating myself as anything that I'm not, you know, capital W writer or capital A artist. And so therefore, I rarely, when I sit down to write, I sit down to write what's in my heart or what the editor has requested. And very rarely do I ever sit down and go, I have a cause. You know, it's like the cause will integrate itself if you're just writing from the heart. But rarely do I sit down with a cause. But in that book, I did have a cause. And that cause was, I had, after much reflection, had come to feel that the American literary scene has completely and utterly ignored the topic of torpedo heaters. And I like torpedo heaters. And I said, by gosh, we're going to address that in this book. And so I'm just going to read one little paragraph, which it is a humorous one. And the other thing about this is this whole paragraph, the punchline it ends with is just, it's for the people I grew up with and their recalcitrance, which I actually love. So he's trying to melt snow off the roof of his pole barn because the pole barn's about to collapse. And so he's using his torpedo heaters. And he said, it was a fundamentally glorious thing, a torpedo heater, loud and basic and atmospherically transformative. It even sounded hot. A blow dryer scaled up to set the curls on a woolly mammoth. He could never really explain why items of this nature gave him such pleasure. His raising, he supposed. It was why he loved old pickup trucks, a good knife, a bolt-action rifle. Layered into the pleasure of their simplicity was the way in which they counterbalanced his philosophical predilections, his susceptibility to fuzzy-headed mawkishness. The fact that he took joy from pushing dirt with a bulldozer ensured he'd never get completely lost in the clouds. There was a decal pasted on the side of the heater. It featured a single declaration bracketed in red exclamation marks. Never leave your torpedo heater unattended. Huh, said Harold, and headed for the house. Them's my people right there. As a dear friend of mine used to say, I'll take that under advisement.
And the ending is hopeful. And
there is a green shoot,
yeah,
literally and figuratively, at the end of the book. Yeah, yes, correct.
You write so much. You've got Michael Perry's voicemail.
Oh, yeah, that's a thing. So for years, I wrote a column for the Wisconsin State Journal,
yeah,
called Roughneck Grace. And 9.5 years, it was wonderful. I loved it. And, you know, when that was kind of coming to an end, we started up this voicemail thing I do, which is basically, I can't quite tell. It's a podcast, I guess, because it's me talking into the microphone. I just sit in my
garage. I love it.
I sit in my little room above the garage there, and I just talk. And I usually read a brief little excerpt from one of the books, an essay or a section from one of the longer books, and talk a little bit about the background. And then I share some photos, usually personal photos related to whatever I'm reading about. And then at the end, a thing I started doing, I guess a year or so ago, I have a section called Marginalia.
Yes.
And I love going back through my old books and where I've written notes or underlined things. And then what I do is I just take a picture of a few of those, and then I say, well, here's what I was thinking at the time, and here's what I think now, or here's why I underlined that. And that seems to have really connected with people. I think we all readers do that. And that comes out once a week. And if you go to anything I talk about today, you're best off just to go to sneezingcow.com.
Yeah.
And if you scroll down that homepage, there's a summary right there that just gives you information about all these things, including the podcast, which is called Michael Perry's Voicemail. And yeah, I read into that, and it goes out once a week. And there are some free ones that come out that if you just sign up, you'll get the free ones. And then if you want to get the weekly one, there's a subscription process. But that has... You know, we kind of did it because we knew that the column was going away, and it's turned out to be just the perfect connection.
And you've done, more than 200?
Tomorrow or Friday, I'll be recording episode number 226.
You know, last night I listened, and it's fitting because today is National Radio Day.
Oh, yeah.
In case you didn't know it. I didn't until Jill told me. But you had, I listened to your piece on listening to the radio.
Oh, yeah. AM skip at night, the big 50,000 watt blowers, yeah.
And that was so much fun, just sitting back and listening. You've got a great radio voice, by the way.
Okay, so now you've given me an excuse, and there are folks in the room who are going to know. I just want to very quickly honor one of my great unlikely mentors. Wouldn't be here without him, a guy named Al Ross. Al Ross had classic, what we call velvet pipes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I met Al, we used to write ads together, and I'd watch him record them, and I watched how he worked with the mic and what he did with his voice. And the other thing, and I don't know if I can pull it off because I wasn't planning on this, but he also could do the greatest cheesy radio guy. And he'd say, welcome everybody, it's Al Ross, slide into the air chair, spit of the platter's the batter, the wax and stacks of wax, the hits that won't quit, I'm your daddy-o on the radio. Here's to Al.
Oh, man.
That wasn't the guy you heard on WPR.
Well, I really enjoyed that piece on listening to the radio. I mean, you used to work, you got your start writing for a truck magazine in some ways.
Yeah, I was scrabbling along as a freelancer, writing anything I could, writing frozen pizza commercials, whatever it took. And I was writing chapters for medical legal textbooks. I was using my nursing degree to get gigs like that and just scraping along. And then one night I was driving across North Dakota listening to AM radio, and I heard a trucker radio station, and it's coming out of the south somewhere, and I pitched the idea of writing about trucker radio to a trucking magazine that I saw in a truck stop, and they said yes, and I wrote that piece for them, and it turned into not only a steady writing gig where I went all over the country, I went on tour with Reba McEntire's Truckers, I went all over, just everything connected to trucks. And the editor was this tremendous fellow who's still a friend. He was fluent in Russian. He was a former investigative reporter for the Nashville Tennessean. And he was a terrific editor. And so I always tell, you know, the magazine world is a shadow of what it was. But I always tell writers, you know, don't... I would have some of my fancier writer friends would, oh, a trucking magazine. I said, you're dang right.
And they paid.
Right. And 25 years later, I'm reselling that essay in a podcast. So recycling, I meant to say.
You had another one recently about chainsawing.
Yes, chainsawing. So I like to say, well, a lot of times at literary events, I'm like the most rugged dude in the room from northern Wisconsin. But in that piece, I talk about how, yeah, I can run a chainsaw, and I know a couple of things from my logging days. But no, when the tree gets to a certain size or a certain location, I call my brothers.
Oh, my goodness. Well... I got lots of callers waiting to talk to you. Georgia in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. My partner Phil and I have just loved the Jesus Cow, and we've seen Mr. Perry at the Stoughton Opera House. And we were wondering if he's ever considered turning that book into, like, a stage play.
I've never considered turning the Jesus Cow into a stage play, but it is halfway turned into a screenplay, and I was working on it 2 weeks ago. So far, there's zero interest in it, but that hasn't stopped me. And I will say that, so here's something I can reveal in public. I've already today said I don't sit down and write things with a purpose. They generally just occur organically. And like the idea for that book, The Jesus Cow, occurred spontaneously. But I did do something very intentional when I wrote that book. And that was, I thought, you know, this is one of the few Mike Perry books that could actually be turned into just like a regular movie. And so, not to do a spoiler, but there's a gigantic explosion at the end of that book. And the whole point of the explosion was, this is going to look really, really cool in the movie.
You know, we had an email from someone in Madison asking the same question. So, about, what, you know, are you working on a stage play for it?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I hadn't thought of that.
Well. Oh, gosh. Well, Tom and DePere, let's go to you. Tom, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just have one quick question for you. With all the stories you've told, have you ever been standing behind a cow when it sneezed?
Okay, so I have a several level answer to that, as you might expect, unless I get cut off. But so, yes, I have been behind a cow when it ejected something other than milk from the back end more than once. And what I always tell people is it is a jaw-dropping experience, although that would not be your best move. And then the second thing I would say, yeah, think about it. So, yes, I have absolutely been splattered in the head and face area. But I would also say I was signing books one time, and I had done the Sneezing Cow story, Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow, which is where sneezingcow.com comes from. And afterwards, I was signing books, and an old farmer walked up, and he said, "Young man, I have a bone to pick with you." And I said, "Well, get in line." And he said, "You always talk about never stand behind a sneezing cow." He said, "But cows don't sneeze, they cough." And I said, "You know what? As a former farm kid, you are absolutely right. They cough and then that happens." But I said, "But as a humorist, a sneezing cow is way funnier than a coughing cow."
Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News Night. Michael Perry, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking with him about his work and his life and questions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Yeah, standing behind a sneezing cow or a coughing cow is... I've had that happen once, but more often, when I was milking cows, I would get nailed by the tail.
Which they would first swab through the gutter.
Exactly.
Yes.
There's nothing like that across your face, man.
Well, and as long as we're exhausting the subject, I'm reminded that in the book Population 485, I write about a call that I was on. A farmer was very seriously injured in his barn. It wasn't funny at all. He was unconscious, had a head injury. But he had landed right behind the cows, and he was on the walkway with his head very close to the gutter and the back of the cows. And I was the first one on scene. And when the pager went off, I was riding my bike. And so I was in my little bike shorts. And so I was the first one there. Well, we couldn't move him because of the injury, and the ambulance wasn't there yet. And so I had to stand. And, you know, when cows get excited...
Yeah.
They tend to jettison everything.
Yep. Yes, they do.
And so I was having to stand and shield this gentleman with my back. And eventually one of the helpers came with a piece of plywood, and he deflected everything around us. That was a vivid, vivid day.
Not going to forget that one.
And in my biking shorts, which the crew I ran with up there wasn't a lot of biking shorts. This was remarked upon.
Oh, boy. Well, speaking of Population 485, you wrote a play from, you know, based on the book, and I saw it at the Stoughton Opera House, and loved it very much. And Jill saw it too, loved it, and Jill puts on plays. And I think she put that play on for you. She put that play on in Lake Mills and is doing it again in October.
Wonderful.
Of this year.
Yeah, I remember sitting down and someone always said, oh, you should sell that as a movie. And I'm like, no, I agree. How do we? That was like when people would always say, you should have your book on Oprah. I go, correct. It's not how it works, but yes. And so, you know, the movie thing never really happened. But then I thought at one point, I'm gonna turn it into a stage play. So I did adapt it into a stage play. And as I'm telling you this, I'm remembering the woman who called earlier and asked about my routine. Here's how it went with the play. For about 3 years, I kept trying to write the play. And I just never quite make it over the hump. And so one day I thought, you know what? This is never going to happen if I don't have a deadline. And so I call my assistant. We put down a deposit and we rented out 3 theaters and booked the play before I had it written.
Oh.
And then I was like,
that's an enticement.
That's inspiration. And then I locked myself into a little room for 3 days straight and finished the rough draft and then, you know, and then started polishing. But yeah, it's been really cool to see it. I put together a little troupe. And we took it around the state for a couple of years, and it was just wonderful. And the thing I loved about it was you would stand in the lobby before the play, and you'd have what you'd expect, you know, the crowd that comes to see plays. But you then also have folks maybe in satin bar jackets, or they had the Maltese Cross insignia, or the EMT cap, and they'd be standing there maybe a little uncomfortable and awkward, and then they'd go in and see the play, and then when they came out, they were laughing, they were crying, and they were telling each other their stories. And that was the part that meant a lot to me, that we weren't just putting on a capital A art event. We were trying to tell the story of some folks who don't always get their story told. So.
That must have, I mean, the response from those folks over the years must have just been fantastic.
It's meaningful, and I still speak. I just spoke at an EMT convention, and I'm going to be speaking to some ER docs here shortly. And, you know, I make hardly any calls anymore. I'm still in the local department as a first responder, but between 5 to 10 calls a year because I'm gone so much. So I'm so wary of that whole I'm a hero business. It's silly and overdone. It's a privilege to serve. And when I wrote that book, I went to great lengths. Like, I am not the best firefighter in the world. I'm not the greatest EMT in the world. But I knew that if I could at least tell their story accurately. And so there's two ways that I can be rewarded with that book. And that's if someone loved the writing and the style, because I worked really hard on that. But also if I can just have somebody on a local fire department come up and go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Water hammer. Water hammer. We know what that is. Yeah. So.
Well, from that, I know you've got an interesting story involving log splitters and motorcycles.
Oh, yes.
A lot of things like that that seem to be not related exactly.
Well, we do heat with wood in our house. We have a backup off-peak heater, but we 90% of our heat comes from wood, and I just feel like there's just no better child-rearing device in the world than firewood. Cause and effect, baby, right there. It's Saturday morning. You like how that feels laying in front of that? Let me show you how that happens. But I'm always running behind, and I wrote one essay one time about there's no more shameful moment for a man than to stand beside his wife and write a check to another man for firewood. But I've done it. But anyways, when we first moved to the farm, I hand split everything, and then after about 2 years, I went, yeah, well, that's just silly. They make wood splitters. They got one over here at the Farm and Fleet. So I do have a wood splitter, and I have a buddy, Mills, who I've written about many times. And Mills and I met in the ditch maybe at 2 a.m. back in the late 80s on our very first EMT call, a horrible accident. And it was in the dark, and we worked together, and then we didn't know it, but that was the beginning of a 30-year friendship. And Mills is just one of those good-hearted dudes, will do anything for you. He's the best sort of friend. So I am always looking to help him out in any way I can, and he needed to borrow my wood splitter one time, and I said, yeah, man, come and get it. And he showed up with his motorcycle. And we have a wonderful picture of my two daughters standing next to him with a wood splitter hooked to a motorcycle. Like, that's the kind of friend that you want right there. And if you'd said to him, well, this doesn't seem like a good idea, he'd go, yeah, I know.
Oh, man. Casey at Rice Lake, we'll give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling, Casey.
Michael, nice to talk to you today. Yeah, I'm in Rice Lake, north of Bay, so northern Wisconsin. And my brother's up in Spooner, which is even more northern Wisconsin. Big fan. And you came to Rice Lake a few months ago, and I invited him to come see us at the library. He said, coming up, we got to get in an hour early. I said, nah, we don't have to. Well, we got back row seats, and I got the side eye, so you performed in front of the audience. But anyway, his birthday is coming up in a few months, and I'm just wondering how to get him a shirt or something. Your merchandise, I'm guessing. I'm guessing Sneezing Cow. Do you have t-shirts for guys that can walk around and be your walking billboard?
Yeah, we on sneezingcow.com, there's a store page. If you buy a book off of there, it's always signed by me. And then also, we do have, we got your t-shirts, we got your can koozies, we got your stickers. But we do, I think for the discriminating man of style north of Highway 8, definitely we have the Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow t-shirt, which we find is very, very popular up in that area. But yeah, thanks. I used to live in Rice Lake. I lived in an apartment above the barbershop on Main Street for about 7 months. I worked for an oral maxillofacial surgeon up there, and I used to come home from that job, and I'd go up in that little apartment, and I'd get my Smith Corona manual typewriter, and I would type stories about working on the ranch in Wyoming and my travels, and I had no idea why, but I just knew I wanted to write a bunch of stuff and someday do something with it. So Rice Lake. And then my kin are from Spooner. A whole bunch of the Perrys come from that Spooner area. And Northwoods Book and Fiber up there is a great little indie bookstore in Spooner. So, yeah.
Yeah. You get around to some of those bookstores once in a while, don't you?
Yeah, independent booksellers hand-sold me into existence back in the 2000s, and they face an uphill battle, and they've been so great to me. So I try to point folks to them whenever possible.
What's next? I mean, what are you working on right now? Let's talk about some of the things that are going on. Of course, you can always go on to your site, sneezingcow.com.
Yeah, Sneezing Cow, and just scroll down that homepage for the overview. And then, I will be this afternoon, when I get back to where I'm going, I will be answering about a week's worth of emails. That's pretty glamorous. And then the next thing I'll be writing is the script for the next podcast that's coming out next week. And then I will be editing that little book about art and commerce that may or may not ever see the light of day, but you don't know until you finish it. So, yeah.
It's always a pleasure, Michael.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's.
I was working on a new song last week, too, so maybe we'll get that done.
We'll get it done. Next time you're on, we'll have you sing it.
I got to get one of them rhyming dictionaries.
Michael Perry, our guest today. He's a great guy. Thanks so much to him, and thanks so much. I tell you what, it takes a whole lot of people to bring this broadcast live from Fall Creek, and I certainly want to thank our friends at Beaver Creek Nature Reserve. And could not have done this without the support of WPR's Eau Claire Regional Manager. Where is she? Molly Gardner. A Senior Regional Manager, Lisa Nalbandian. Our technical directors, Tom Blaine, Tyler Ditter, and Sarah Hopeful with us right here in Fall Creek, and Jeff Robbins back in Madison. Clara Neipert, of course, our producer today. She's sitting in a closet right now. It's about 4x4, and she's doing the work for that. Of course, there she is. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and thanks so much to this great audience with us today. You've been wonderful, and thank you all for listening. Really appreciate it, and I hope you'll stay with us. There's lots more in store on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.